Welcome to the Retrospect Podcast, a show where people come together from different walks of life to discuss a topic from their generation's perspective. My name is Ian, and as always, I'm joined by Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And Stoney.
Hello.
Okay, here we go. It's a big day.
Big day. Got a guest in the studio today, veteran political analyst Jim Engster. Wow. Thank you for driving Hello. All the way out here to the show.
My honor. It's great to be on your fabulous show.
We had a conversation, and that's what our show really is. It's just a big conversation a while back, and we were talking about the election and just things, how it works. And Ian went, wow, that would be a great show to have. It's just talking about politics and how the election works in the country and things like that. And I said, ooh, wait, I think I know somebody that may be great. And so I reached out to you and just was so honored when you said you would come on. So you feel like talking about the election a little bit and some politics?
I'm good talking with you, and I know I'm in good hands, and I appreciate your commitment to making our world better.
That's it. Mm. That's us.
I know that it's a big year this year with, you know, the election happening, and that's what kind of sparked what he was talking about. Was there's a lot of stuff that there's a lot of terminology, there's a lot of words, there's a lot of things that I don't feel like people, specifically in my age bracket and maybe younger, that are now, you know, voting age now, that I don't think fully understand or can wrap their head around a little bit. And like I said, I know we got a handful of months until things start getting real.
It's going to get really real.
And mm-hmm. and that's what I was talking about it with these guys, it was, how can we spread awareness a little bit? How can we talk about it? How can we make it feel less like it's this kind of otherworldly thing and make it a little bit more understandable? What is some of your background that you have kind of been?
Well, I've been covering elections since 1979.
Okay.
When I was a student at LSU. And back in the day, Louisiana elections generated more interest than presidential elections.
Yes.
But that has changed a lot. About twice as many people voted in the presidential election in Louisiana in 2020 as voted in the 2023 governor's election.
Really?
We only had about 35% of the voters cast ballots on October 14th. So we're more ginned up about the presidential election. And some would say, why? Because often local politics affect people more than national. Mm. And in Louisiana, it's a given that the Republican candidate will, until things change, will win the presidential election in Louisiana, meaning the Republican will get all the electoral votes. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton was the last Democrat to win. He did win here in 92 and 96, but no Democrat since. And Donald Trump, if he's breathing, will win Louisiana's mm-hmm. 8 electoral votes in November. So why do we vote? We vote because we either like somebody or don't like them. And Trump is one of those polarizing figures like David Duke. That was the last time we really had a heavy turnout in a governor's election. That was 1991. About 80% of the electorate cast ballots then. And obviously in that case, it was a large anti-Duke vote. But in Louisiana, it's more of a case in which more people like Trump than don't. And it's largely based in our state somewhat like it is in Mississippi, in which about 85% of the white people in 2020 voted for Trump and 95% of the black people voted for Biden. Hmm. Right now, there are more white people than black people in Louisiana, so that means that the person who has more white votes is more likely to win, and Trump won going away. He won by 400,000 votes in Louisiana. He lost by 7 million nationally, but he won by 400,000 here, as he did in 2016. So we are a member of the Southeastern Conference. There are 12 states in the Southeastern Conference, and those 12 states have 160 electoral votes. And in two elections, Donald Trump's 23-1 in the SEC. Mm-hmm. So you start, as he likely will, and I think this time he's more than likely to carry Georgia, which he lost narrowly last time. He'll have 160 electoral votes right from the start. Mm-hmm. And you only need 270 to win. So that shows you the might of this region. And when it monolithically votes one way, it can make a huge difference in the election.
Why do you think that former President Trump, what has made him this polarizing figure? Because, I mean, we all knew Donald Trump before even the whole thing with the whole presidential thing started. I mean, from my understanding, he was pretty much ran around in Democratic circles back in the day. And so what's changed? I mean,
he's actually won multiple awards and shook hands and stood there with Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and he's won multiple awards from the NAACP.
I don't understand all the criticisms I've heard about him, and I'm sitting there going, well, none of these things really never came up before. Now, of course, he didn't run for public office, and of course,
against Hillary Clinton, and as soon as he ran against her,
he ran against her as an opponent, but there seems to be, it's kind of like going up 10 levels of hate, the people who dislike him. It's almost to a point now, I look at him going, it's like people losing sleep over this stuff, and it's like, why do you think he generates that kind of reaction in people? I mean, I don't understand that, but what is your... looking at this from a more holistic standpoint, why does he react? He generates the reaction that he does.
He, as you stated, never ran for office, but he was a Democrat, and I think he's an opportunist, and he's played his cards really well. And politics is all about timing, and he came along at a time when the country was ready for him, and the media, and I'm talking about all media, whether it's conservative, liberal, or balanced. They followed his every move and gave him a lot of free publicity. And he says outrageous things, and he's conducted his life in a way that most Americans would not or could not. And I think from his followers, who are just as passionate as his detractors, that's why they like him. They'd like to live his life. Most men in America, and we're talking white men, would love to have $1 billion and lots of women and be accountable to nobody and live their life on their own terms and not have to pay the price and of doing that. And most of us, if we try doing that, we don't go very far, and we might end up on the wrong side of the law. But for Trump, it's worked, and until now, and it may continue to work for him. He may very well be elected. His detractors, I'm sure, resent his success and flaunting rules that are in place that are either stated or not. I remember in 1987, a year before the presidential election of 88, Gary Hart was the favorite. And he got caught with a woman who was not his wife on a boat in Bimini called the Monkey Business. And that was the end of Gary Hart. But Donald Trump, any allegation seems to be met with even more support from his followers and more disdain from his detractors. And we live in a divided country, and Trump seems to be the dividing line. When I was a little kid, and I'm a little older than anyone in this room, I remember when I was, 6 years old, then Cassius Clay won the heavyweight championship of the world, and ultimately, just a few months later, became Muhammad Ali. He refused to be inducted in the draft and serve in the war. And of course, they weren't going after other athletic heroes at that time. You didn't see Jack Nicklaus being drafted or Joe Namath or Pete Maravich go down the list, but Muhammad Ali was, and he refused to go. And you could usually tell a whole lot about somebody by just asking them what they thought of Muhammad Ali, about their belief system. And I think today we have the same thing with Trump. When somebody says they like Trump, we know pretty much what they stand for. And when they say they don't like Trump a lot, we pretty much know what they stand for. So he is a polarizing figure. And in one way, he has conquered the world, because I do think most Americans every day think of him several times a day. He's in everybody's mind. And in that case, he is possibly the most infamous or famous, depending on how you look at it, person in the history of our country. There are more people, and most of the people in this country think about him on a regular basis. Some are obsessed with him on both sides. I know people in this community where we live who their pastime, and these are people who are business people. They're not nuts, but they travel around the country to Trump rallies. That's their pastime. That's what gets them going. It's kind of like going to the Bahamas or to Rio de Janeiro.
It's interesting that you framed it in the way you did, because I feel like I've subconsciously knew that, but I've never really thought about it like that. Of like, you can really gauge somebody, by that sort of, if someone's like, oh, I'm vehemently against him, or I'm super on board with him, like, okay, I kind of know where to gauge how to conversate or handle you in a way of like, you know, what should I stay away from, what should I talk about, and those kind of things. And like, I've never really thought about it like that, but it's very true. If not just for, you know, him being president, other aspects of my life where, like, as a musician and an artist, if you feel very strongly against something, I'm like, okay, cool, I know where to kind of place you in my head, at least, you know, what are we going to probably agree on, what are we going to disagree on, that sort of stuff, which is interesting.
And I hear the same thing about Trump that I heard about Duke 30 or so years ago. People will say, I don't like him, but I like his politics.
Yeah.
Which usually means I like him a whole lot. And Duke would under-poll, meaning more people would actually be for him on election day than it showed in polls. And there's some of that in Trump, too. So the fact that Trump is leading, and as we speak, we're 30 weeks from an election, he's leading. He's under indictment in four places. And
That's only because the judicial system won't indict the President Biden crime family.
Is that what you think?
Yes, I absolutely do.
Well, I would disagree with you there. Mm-hmm. They've had every opportunity to do it.
Well, he's weaponized them against the conservatives.
Well, many of those people, Stoney, were put in place by Trump. Many of the prosecutors are Republicans.
Some.
Most. Some.
But if you look at the liberals, what they're doing is they're having sex with each other. And
well,
that's
Donald
not
Trump had sex with a porn star.
Okay.
Yes, he did.
Because he also has a letter that she says the affair didn't happen, and that just came out last week.
Well, he paid her $130,000 to write that letter.
He didn't pay that money.
Bill Barr. It was Michael Cohen.
Yes, Cohen.
Who was working for Donald Trump. Now, why would a guy who wrote Art of the Deal pay $130,000 to somebody to deny something that never happened? That seems like the art of the steal
hush
to
money
me.
Happens a lot on well, both Donald sides Trump, of that ticket.
Donald Trump was a wimp to do that. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's a big fat guy too. He can't bench press his weight. He's not much of a man. He talks tough, but he's really not.
Well, you know, I have a question.
Yes.
How do political strategies in Louisiana differ from those in other key battleground states in the U.S.? So could you help us define a battleground state? And as Louisiana is a battleground state, how do they differ from some of the other battleground states across the nation?
Well, we're not a battleground state. It's a given that Trump wins Louisiana. They're only of seven, I think.
Well, do you think, maybe I guess the direction I want to go with that is Louisiana has been primarily a Republican state, but we also just elected John Bel Edwards twice, and he was one of the first, you know, double term governors of the, you know, Democrat Party. And now we're going back to Republican again. But could it be turning into a battleground state?
No.
Okay.
No, we're not a battleground state. And the Electoral College is flawed because, as a result of the fact that we know Trump will win Louisiana and Trump will win Texas, and Biden will win California, and Biden will win New York, candidates are not going to go to about 43 states unless they're there to raise money. Right. So the only states they go to are the seven battleground states they're listing now, and that's probably right, and that's Georgia, North Carolina, and I think Trump is likely to carry those.
Ohio would be another
one. Not anymore.
It's not a red
state. That's a Trump state.
Okay.
What about Wisconsin?
Wisconsin. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Nevada.
Has Colorado kind of become one? Because they were, that for years state. And years.
They were.
They were a conservative state, and now they're a liberal state now. Well, so would that be kind of,
All those people from California moved over there. Changed the politics. Well,
I'll tell you a funny story there. When I lived on the Western Slope, and the interstate system coming from California, there was these large billboards. And it said, if you're from California and you plan on staying more than 3 days, turn around and go back. We don't want you here. Well, those signs are no longer there. And it's turning into a large liberal state.
Colorado?
Colorado,
yes. Colorado's a blue state now. Mm-hmm. So there won't be much action in Colorado. No. And if a candidate carries, like, if a Republican wins Colorado, a Republican's going to win. Mm-hmm. And if a Democrat wins Ohio, Democrat's going to win. Now, I was talking with your friend James Carville the other day on the air, and he said that if Biden, with all of his flaws as a candidate, were to win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, and win everything else Hillary won, the Democrats would win the election. Well, that's not true because of the fact that there are fewer electoral votes in the states that Hillary won 8 years ago than there are now. And I did the math, and actually, if that were to happen, meaning Trump would win Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, the other battleground, and Biden wins Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, the electoral vote would be 269-269.
Oh, wow.
Which means it would go to the House of Representatives, which means it would go to the current House, not the new House, meaning that Mike Johnson of Louisiana would likely, I would think, make Donald Trump the president of the United States. And I'm sure that would be a prescription for unity in our country.
Oh, gosh.
We talk about unity. Yeah. I hear that a lot. The fact of the matter is, can we really ever be united with the state of the world, the country? Is that utopia possible? Because I hear the word unity all the time. There's a lot of people I don't want to be unified with because I radically disagree with their version of America versus my version of America. So how do we survive with the current projection in which we're going? Because unless something from the outside happens that kind of like changes the paradigm, so to speak. I don't see us ever being unified in this country. I just don't. We've become so entrenched in our camps and we're not really able to kind of reach out across the aisle, so to speak, and shake hands with people. I mean, our conversations, you talk about something, and it's, if you disagree with me, you hate me. And there's no longer this talking that we once were able to do in this country. What changed? What happened to us as Americans?
Part of it is the fact way campaigns are run, and each side picks at the other side and goes after candidates on their most vulnerable issues, and the stuff like transgender issues that plays well, but it's really not one of the top 20 issues in America,
right?
But it's an issue that plays well, and that's an example. But We've always been a divided country to some extent. That's part of the way in a free society with two major parties, the way things work. And after all, in 1804, not far after the Revolutionary War, the Vice President of the United States shot and killed the Secretary of the Treasury in a duel. So we've always been divided. We had a civil war. But one thing that has changed, which I do find alarming, is that unlike America in World War II, when we united and went to war, and collectively we were all together for one purpose, I don't know that we can do that now if we were attacked. We united, I thought, after 9/11, but today, if you're for Biden, you wouldn't want to fight for Trump. And if you're for Trump, you wouldn't want to fight for Biden. And part of that is of their doing. Biden got out of Vietnam with a doctor's excuse, fake asthma. Trump got out of Vietnam with a doctor's excuse, fake bone spurs. And yet they are running for an office and have both won the office in which they have the moral authority, they say, to send Americans, men and women, off to fight wars of which they would not fight. They proved it. And so every day when they look in the mirror, they see a coward, the coward who wouldn't serve when it was their time. And from my point of view, it would be better to have somebody who didn't make the choices that they made, but that's the choice we have. And Americans have stated pretty eloquently they're not really, they're not in favor of that choice, but that's what we have. And we also have two really old guys. Biden, it will be 82 in November, and Trump will be 78 in June. So collectively, they'll be 160 years old. And in 1960, and I was the only one alive at that time in this room, but I barely, but we had two World War II veterans running against each other. We had 47-year-old Richard Nixon, 43-year-old John Kennedy, and they both had fought in World War II. And they were collectively 90 years old. So we have two guys who collectively will be 160 years old on Election Day. And 64 years ago, we had two guys who were 90 years old. So we're going from an average age of 45 to an average age of 80. And even though we're living longer, we're not living that much longer. And we hopefully will not be in a situation where we have to storm the beaches of another country to liberate the world. But we might. And I don't think we're united enough to do it. And that is a problem. And most Americans want the same things. They want freedom. They want to live their lives without turmoil. They want the resources to advance their lives. And despite our flaws, we have a better standard of living now than we've ever had. But we have division that is substantial, and it's palpable. And I know Democrats who hate Trump more than they hate Putin, and Republicans who hate Biden more than they hate Putin. Well, Vladimir Putin's a really bad guy. We might have to go to war against him. What happens then? I'm not certain. It may not be a good thing as far as how our country will react to a true evil person. He makes Biden and Trump look like romper room because he is a true bad guy. Mm-hmm. But right now, the country is more fixated on the other side and all the demons that are involved with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, rather than trying to resolve matters and live as harmoniously as we can and unite on the important things, which I do think most Americans would be in accord with. But we accent things that divide us, and we don't emphasize things that unite us, and that's how campaigns are run and won. And Americans often say they dislike negative campaigning, negative advertising, but it works.
Well, it's the fear factor. Campaigns use fear. That's the biggest thing that they use.
I agree.
Today.
I agree with you, Stone.
Why? So, I guess do you know potentially why the average age has gone up? Is there just not enough younger people that are getting into running and that sort of thing, or they're not? Are they being pushed out? Or
it's possible that a lot of qualified people, maybe the most qualified people, don't want any part of politics. They don't want their whole lives to be on display for the masses to see. I wouldn't want mine to be on display. And if they have families, they certainly don't want their wives and kids to hear everything they've done. And some things they haven't done or accused of doing. Everything we hear is not, I'll give you, is not necessarily true. But I remember Pat Paulson, a guy who ran for president in 1968 when he was on the Smothered Brother Comedy Hour, on the Stag Party, by the way, the straight-talking American government party, the Stag Party. He said, rumors of the worst kind, true rumors. Mm-hmm. And most of us have things in our lives we don't want the world to see.
Yes, but they were before cell phones and video capture on those cell phones.
There you go, and so now we have, and can really be humiliated. But now, I'm sure candidates will say, look, that's not me, that's AI.
Yeah. Right.
Well, it's,
don't believe your lying eyes. That's not me.
I had a terrible accident June of last year, and I have some severe memory problems.
And a couple of people asked me, well, what do you do about the memory problems? And I says, I really don't remember what happened in the 80s and early 90s anymore.
You don't.
And so I said, what I'll do is I'm thinking about running for office and let everybody drag up my past, and then maybe I'll remember some of it, or at least I'll know what happened.
Well, if I were running,
and just so you know, just so you know, Jim, there is actually a hashtag out there, Stoney for President.
No.
I did not start that, but there is a hashtag, Stoney for President.
Yeah, I remember Barbara Streisand had a song, Stoney End. But if I were running, everything I did before 65, and I'm 66 now, I would just say it was a youthful indiscretion.
Youthful indiscretion.
So Jim, what made you get interested in poly? I mean, what was the factors that?
Yeah, really, you said you started this when you were back at LSU.
So got you into all this?
I grew up in New Orleans and in Little Rock, and both Arkansas and Louisiana are good laboratories for politics. And,
yes, they are.
And Louisiana, for example, we have 1 out of 73 people in the country, but we sure generate a lot more than 1 out of 73 news stories. So I was exposed to it at an early age. First memory I have, it would have been when I was 3 years and 5 days old. I remember John Kennedy taking the oath of office, January 20th, 1961. And I was alive. I was 5 when he was killed. So those things made an impression on me. And I don't know that our country has recovered from what happened on November 22nd, 1963, but when I was 10 years old, I was in the fifth grade. I was at St. Patrick's grade school, elementary school in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I remember I polled our student body, all of those who would answer. And, of course, we're talking small kids, 1 through 8th grade, but who they wanted in the 68 presidential election. And that was Nixon, Humphrey, and George Wallace. Wallace carried both Arkansas and Louisiana, by the way. Nixon won the election, but Humphrey was an LSU graduate, vice president of the United States, and he lost a narrow race. And I remember it was almost dead even between the three candidates. And I found that fascinating, that here we had a school, we were all white, all Catholic, all from generally the same backgrounds, and yet we had three different candidates with varying degrees of distinction. I mean, there was definitely a choice. Nixon was much different than Humphrey, and Wallace was much different than either one of them. So, and yet it was basically one third. And I thought then, well, at 10 years old, I had an epiphany that our country is divided, at least ideologically. But I think at that time, in 1968, we would have responded better to an attack on our country. But as we know, we didn't respond well to Vietnam, which that was probably the turning point. That was an ill-advised war, and it really started under Democrats, but was escalated under Nixon, a Republican, and it was a war that scarred our nation, and we're still paying the price.
If I may, it was also the first televised war. It hit television pretty hard, where World War II, you actually had to go to the movie theater and see the little newsreels and stuff. But the Vietnam War was primetime TV.
Maybe a little bit of Korea, but
sure.
But
Vietnam was
most people didn't have a television set in 1952, but they did in 1968, and the war lasted all the way to 1975.
That's kind of my next question to you, is how has the digital age altered political campaigning and voter engagement in Louisiana?
Everybody's a journalist now, and on things like this, we can say things, and largely it's unabated now. I think the people here are presenting things honestly and forthrightly, and maybe saying things they wouldn't say in conventional media, and that's why these kinds of programs are good. But
you're talking about the podcast?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
because you said something earlier about AI, and I was kind of ready for my question.
Well, AI, you can alter. We could take things that we're saying now and change a few words and make it sound like we said something.
Because Ian's a big fan of AI.
No, so.
Well,
no, I'm not.
But AI can also be used. I think it's great that we can bring John Lennon back from the grave. We can bring Elvis Presley back from the grave. But I don't know.
How do you see that shaping the future in Louisiana? Has been a good thing. Is it something that's going to help us or hurt us mostly?
I don't know. It's too early to tell. Generally, I think it's good to have various means of expression and have media available for everyone. But when we talked about unity, I think back in the day when I was a young person, and you people are not too far behind me, when we would have three major networks,
yep, sure, right,
we all had a common experience because most of us watched one of those networks the night before. And if it was a really big show like Who Shot J.R., yeah, just about everybody watched
right.
it.
Dallas.
Now, I was thinking of something the other day, and I was trying to think of what it was. It was the O.J. Simpson case.
Mm, yeah.
The Bronco chase, the Bronco. O.J. died the other day, and he was a guy who, if he had not been a football hero, would have been a nobody. But he was a great football player, and he parlayed that into fame, and he was a good-looking guy, and he became an actor, and then he killed his wife and her friend, and he got away with it. And there was a chase. 95 million people watched that.
Wow.
I remember 95 million. Well, the New York Times a couple of years ago had 2 days in a row on the front page Tucker Carlson and pointed out that he was the most influential person in media at that time. That was their opinion, and it probably was true. But his nightly viewership was 3 million. Mm. And 95 million, that's just 30 years ago. 95 million watched the O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, which it turned out to be much ado about nothing, but it was great drama. But we had that common thread, like Walter Cronkite.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Huge, huge numbers when he was anchoring the CBS News. But today we're fractured because most of us, when we go home at night and then we go to work the next day, we have different experiences. We don't have that commonality where we can, well, what did you think about this or that or the other? We have to inform others of what we saw and why it meant something to us. And there's nothing terribly wrong with that. But when we have a lack of unity in our country, everything that is different, I think, becomes a source of anxiety, perhaps. And we don't have the cohesion as far as our common experiences we had years ago.
Well, but back then, it was the news that you trusted. You could trust them. You could trust Walter Cronkite.
Well,
and to a certain extent. I mean, I'm sure there was still a little bit of play in there, but that's who you went to find out the information. And now information is so readily available, and sometimes it's not true. And I think more on the internet, more than not, it's not true. And
sometimes intentionally not true.
Exactly. And part of that is back when President Obama was in office, he did the Smith-Mundt Act or whatever, that until that time, the U.S. government had to tell the truth and they could not use propaganda against their own people. And he overturned that, which allowed now even the government to use propaganda and not tell us the truth. And so that's even in a governmental, that's not just, you know, journalism. That's our own government saying, okay, we're not going to tell you all the truth all the time.
Well, the government,
I know, here we
has not done that.
Before that, the choice was not to tell you. And now they can choose to tell you and it not be the truth.
Well, there was the Gary Powers case and the Eisenhower mm-hmm. administration. The government has always, to some extent, told us what we need to know rather than what really is. But part of that is considered to be national security, and I understand that to some extent. But as a journalist, there's really a good ethical and moral question as far as how you cover a war, because mm-hmm. you know, if I'm covering an election or a football game, I may have an interest in who wins or loses, but I'm not going to do anything to help one side or the other. And most journalists are like that. Mm-hmm. But in covering a war, if you have information that's injurious to the United States. It's considered to be a lack of patriotism, and I can understand that, to report that and to make our soldiers be at risk. Often journalists travel with the United States in warfare, and so...
Wasn't it Geraldo Rivero that gave up one... They gave up a position of a group one time in Afghanistan or somewhere like that. He gave up where their position on the air.
Well, that wouldn't be a good thing.
No. But,
so we, even as journalists, when it comes to national security, we have a different perspective. And we also use the term, and when we're talking about the United States at war with another country, we use the term we. Where if I'm covering LSU, I'm an LSU graduate. I like it when LSU does well, but I'm not going to, if they beat Alabama, I'm not going to say we played or we beat Alabama. I wasn't on the field. Mm-hmm. Or they beat us.
Right?
I would only say that if I were actually in uniform and had pads on. But and I resent it when journalists use that pronoun, we. But we have a different perspective when it comes to war, and most Americans are not going to do anything to put our soldiers in harm's way. But what if there was some rogue leader who was about to lead a platoon on a death mission and a journalist had information about that? There are all kinds of ethical questions that come into play, and at times we have to make tough choices, and it's... It's fortunately in my career, I've never been, actually I was in Gaza once and bombs were dropping, but I've never been in an all-out war and I never had to decide whether or not something was palatable for the masses or not, or palatable for my own safety. But sometimes journalists have to make that call, and sometimes presidents and other leaders of countries in the United States in particular have to do that. And in that case, I'm willing on some cases to give them the benefit of the doubt on some cases.
Mm-hmm.
But what was that song by Merle Haggard? Remember when Nixon lied to us all on TV? We're rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell. What was it back when a joint was a bad place to be?
Right. Who are some of the historical political figures from Louisiana who you think have had a lasting impact on its political culture?
Well, certainly in the last century, Huey Long.
Right.
There's no doubt that.
I was a bodyguard for one of his cronies.
Really?
And heard some really interesting stories about him. Yeah.
Huey had a full life. He died at 42, as did Elvis Presley and Bobby Kennedy.
Yep,
but he did a lot in those 42 years, and you know, in the Great Depression, we're a poor state, and 20% of all the construction in the U.S. was going on in Louisiana. So he did a lot. I think he definitely had more of an impact than anybody else. And then there was Edwin Edwards, who was governor for 16 years. He logged 5,784 days in the governor's mansion and 3,007 days in federal prison. So he had more than 24 years of
state service,
public housing.
Yeah.
You know, Huey Long is an interesting figure because I often wonder if, you know, Louisiana has always been a little different from the other southern states. It's different. It's been different from Mississippi, Arkansas, Georgia, Alabama, Florida. And I often wonder if Huey Long would have not come on the scene, would Louisiana have gone the same way culturally as those other southeastern states? In your opinion, you think he really emphasized the class angle on the population versus I don't think that's as prevalent in other southern states. At least that's the impression I got growing up. Now, is that kind of a fair statement? I mean,
he was the people's governor.
He did that, but he died in 1935. And in the 1960 census, 25 years after his death, New Orleans, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, and Miami were all about the same size. They're all in the top 10. And New Orleans is down to 1 million metro. 1 million. Baton Rouge is almost 900,000. In your lifetime, Baton Rouge will probably catch New Orleans. But New Orleans didn't grow. The other cities did. And I don't think we can blame that on Huey Long. But maybe we can blame it on a tradition of corrupt politics to some extent. But Louisiana has issues environmentally that other states don't. It's hard for New Orleans to expand when it's got water everywhere you go. It's not like you can just build out. And the weather is rugged. It's rugged in Houston, too. But they grew, and we didn't. And we do have some resources that they don't have. We're the third largest energy producer in the U.S., and yet we're the second poorest state. And we're losing population. I was in Atlanta over the weekend, and the top three growing cities last year in the country, were Dallas, Houston, and Atlanta.
Really?
And New Orleans, of course, and Louisiana lost population.
I had heard Atlanta. I didn't realize both Houston and Dallas
were number one and two. Wow. And you look at the top 10, every state is in the Sun Belt. It's either in Texas, Florida, Georgia, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte's in there. That's kind of the Sun Belt. It's a southern state. There are no states.
Nashville's probably in there, too.
Nashville was not, surprisingly.
Really?
But over the course of time, you're right, it's been growing exponentially and now is considered a great American city. But Baton Rouge and New Orleans are not growing as fast as those other states. And it used to be that we were losing congressional seats because we were growing. We just weren't growing as fast as these other states.
Mm-hmm.
So it's done on a proportional basis. And when you go from 1.4% of the national population where we are now, and we were at 1.8, every time you lose a point here or there, a fraction of a point, it means losing a congressional seat. We likely will lose another one in the next census.
That's right.
In 2030. And we're washing away, too. If we don't do something, New Orleans will be no longer in perhaps as soon as 50 years. Now, we'll probably do some things, but whether people would want to move and be a part of that, we're talking about an existential survival mission here. They probably would prefer, especially if they're older, to live in a place without these weather extremes. And we have plenty of them there, and Huey Long's not responsible for the weather. But he was, I think, a corrupt politician to some extent. But he was doing it. He's the politician who did it for the lower class.
He was
a Robin Hood, and definitely the state advanced. Look at what happened to LSU. He made things happen. But he died, and if he hadn't been shot on September 8, 1935, he probably would have been shot at some other point.
Right.
And one of the things, when we were talking nationally, that concerns me more than anything else is we haven't had a president wounded by gunfire since Ronald Reagan. That's been 43 years. And I think Trump or Biden could be assassinated, and can you imagine the division that would cause in the country? And,
it'd be horrible.
Yeah,
it'd be absolutely
horrible.
It'd be devastating, and it only takes one bad apple to pull something like that off. At least to try, and of course there are attempts, but usually they don't get close enough. But we live in an open society, and those things can happen. And what happened to Huey Long and John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and George Wallace, Martin Luther King, that could happen to somebody today. There's no reason to believe that we're immune from that today, and it's been a long time, and it's almost inevitable it will happen. And our country is already divided, so you can only imagine what would happen if something like that were to occur. But I often wonder what would have happened to Huey Long if he had lived. He was only 42. And he might have ended up being president of the United States. I think Donald Trump's taken a lot of Huey's methods. He's a populist from the right. Huey was a populist from the left. But a lot of those methods have been employed, and the passion that he is the savior is the same as it was with Huey Long.
Right.
But we were right in the middle of a depression. I mean, Huey Long was killed in 1935. He was elected governor in 1928. But Edwin Edwards was certainly a inheritor of that type of politics. He was born in 1927, the year before Huey was elected governor. And he had the capacity to do things for our state with his great charisma and his ability to sell that I think he missed some opportunities, and that's a shame. But he was a true Louisiana character, and we do have a lot of those. You mentioned others like Stoney, a guy I used to interview a lot. I used to interview him just for sport. I've got a box of reel-to-reel tapes. Was John McKithen, who brought us the Superdome. And he was from Columbia, Louisiana, and he's the one who brought us the Superdome. And he was a guy who, in 1941, he was 23. He was fresh out of LSU Law School, and he flunked his physical. But he lied to get in the war, and he fought in Japan, and he jumped in a foxhole when his platoon was under attack, and a guy jumped on top of him named Walter Fox, and Walter Fox was shot in the back and killed by a Japanese soldier, and John McKithen named his son Walter Fox McKithen, who became the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he died tragically, too, but Big John McKithen was quite a character. And Louisiana has elected some really smart governors. McKithen was a brilliant guy. Edwin Edwards was brilliant. John Bell Edwards was real smart. Bobby Jindal was a very smart guy. Mm-hmm. He is a very smart guy. And Buddy Romer, who was, I think those are the five that I would put at a level way above most people in our state, and certainly above my level. But our people are yearning for something better than what we've had. And
I mean, I can kind of attest to that a little bit, not nearly in like a local government aspect, but like specifically, like it's something bigger than that. It's been hard to like really get involved. I want to get more involved, especially because I know I'm in that demographic where a lot of the people in my age bracket and younger don't vote or don't contribute because they feel like, you know, they don't, their vote doesn't matter, or, you know, whatever their excuse may be. But it's hard sometimes when, like, I feel like the only two options I have, I'm not super happy with. And it's like, it's hard to get involved whenever I feel like it's so corrupt at times. I feel like it's so messy, and it feels like it's not, like, I feel like nothing that's going on is, you know, there to help me out or to help me see like a brighter and more positive future or anything like that. It just feels like more fighting and more division and more. So it's like, it's been difficult over the past few years, you know, with all this stuff going out, but you know,
well, hopefully that will change. And what comes next? We know in 2028, neither Biden nor Trump will be on the ballot.
Yeah.
Neither one. Biden by then will be 86. If he were to lose, he would be eligible to run, but he's not going to run. We know that. And he may not be alive. Trump may not be alive, but we'll have a different Republican, a different Democrat.
Right.
But what kind? Will it be somebody like Trump?
Yeah.
Is there anybody like Trump?
Right.
And I would imagine the Democrats will go for somebody who is different and younger than Biden, but will it be somebody so progressive that they have no chance of winning a state like Louisiana? Because in our state, we're still relatively conservative when it comes to social issues. And and that's where John Bell Edwards, who was the only Democrat in statewide office, survived. And I think he did, because even though he was, I think, liberal on many social issues as far as bread and butter, he was conservative on guns and abortion, and he was a West Point guy, so he didn't come across as a wild-eyed radical, and he was able to win. But he won in part because he had two wounded opponents. He had David Vitter the first time,
yep,
and then the second time he had Eddie Rasponi, who was 70 years old and had never run for office. And Rasponi still almost beat him, lost by 40,000 votes. And Rasponi actually is a good man, but he had never run for office, and he didn't know what he was doing. And usually those who excel in politics do it like everybody else because they've been there. Now, Trump is the exception, but Trump won a close one, lost a close one when in the Electoral College, even though he touted it as a landslide. He got over 300 electoral votes the first time, and Biden did the second time. If you take a few of those states and slice and dice them, really Trump won in the Electoral College by about 40,000 votes the first time and lost by about 40,000 votes the second time. So even that's the way it is, and that's the way the game is played. I think it would be better for us to have a national vote in which every vote were the same, because now Louisiana has 8 electoral votes, and we have 4.7 million people. Now, Wyoming has 3 electoral votes and has about 600,000 people. So your vote in Wyoming counts more than it does in Louisiana.
That's right.
In Louisiana. And in Louisiana, our votes count more than those people in Texas or California. The bigger state you're in, the less your vote counts. And really? I thought we had one person, one vote. And it's the only election in America that I'm aware of in which you can win and actually lose the overall vote because of the Electoral College. Now, it creates a lot of drama. It's fun for political pontificators because you look at that map and we could have great drama. Imagine if it is 269 to 269, or imagine if, like it was in Florida, 537 votes decides the one state that is determining who will win. And, and that's what happened in 2000. It could happen again, and I don't think that's good. And it almost worked. It generally, the last few times, it's been Democrats who have won the overall vote and lost in the Electoral College. Clinton in 2016, Hillary Clinton, and Gore in 2000. But John Kerry, if he had carried Ohio, which he almost did in 2004, he would have won the election. And George W. Bush, he won the overall vote by 3 million votes. So it could swing both ways. And that's why I don't think it'll ever be changed unless it hurts one party as much as it hurts the other.
I'm curious, do you have any predictions or any kind of, like, I do with your years of...
For this election?
Do you see anything changing, anything happening, or... Do you have any idea, any insider knowledge that we may not have?
I don't, but we are getting close. 30 weeks is,
I know.
30 weeks from tomorrow as we speak, 210 days. I do think that about 43 states are already settled. And so that brings it down to those 7. And I think Trump is likely, that's why they're battleground states, we don't know, but I think he's likely to win Georgia and North Carolina. And if he does win there, then that means Biden has to win. He has to win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, most likely to win. Hillary Clinton lost all 3 of those states in 2016 narrowly, and Biden won all 3 narrowly in 2020. So it's going to be a close race. And I have no doubt that if Trump does not win, that he will once again claim that there was some kind of fraud.
Oh, of course.
And there's always some fraud, but it's yet to be proved that there was enough fraud to overturn the election of 2020. But that just adds to the division in the country. And Trump, if he's now, he's an amazing guy. He is a big man. He doesn't handle stress well. I don't know what his blood numbers are, but he can't be in the greatest of shape at 78. But he's got boundless energy. No doubt he's a much more energetic guy than his opponent, Mr. Biden. What if he loses a close one? If he's hale and hearty, he'll run again.
What would happen? Okay, you can only do 2 terms. If he were to win again, could he do 2 more terms? He can only do that 1 term, right?
If you're governor of Louisiana, you can do it.
You could do it again.
But as president of the United States,
it's 2 terms.
Two
right?
terms total, right?
2 terms are 10 years.
Okay.
So if somebody is put in office with less than half of the term to go, they can serve that term and then win twice. But but you can only win twice. But if he loses, and let's say he loses a close one and he's in reasonably good health, he's got this enormous following. And if he loses a close one, I'm sure again, he'll say, look, I should have won. So he may run again.
Wow.
He may run again at 82. And this time it would be against probably Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
If Biden wins, she'll be the front runner to get the Democratic nomination.
Or Michelle Obama.
Well, that's possible, too. That's possible, although she's said she's not interested. But you know how that works. Yeah, it's like Bobby Jindal said, you know, when a candidate says he or she is praying whether to run, you know, God never says no.
Yeah.
God never I prayed and the Lord told me not to do it. The Lord always says yes. And poor Bobby Jindal, who had a great future, he got no electoral votes, zero. And no delegates. He didn't get a nomination, obviously, but he got zero delegates. But he is younger. We only have three, by the way, we only have three living governors in Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, Bobby Jindal, and Jeff Landry. And how many living presidents we have? We got Jimmy Carter, barely.
Barely. Mm.
He's still alive. We got Bill Clinton, George Bush, Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden. That's six. So we got six living presidents, and we've got three living governors. And Bobby Jindal is younger than both Landry or Edwards, and he's all dressed up and no place to go. He had a great future, but it didn't work out. But he almost was elected governor in 2003. He lost to Kathleen Blanco, and if he had, he would have been 32 as governor. He would have gotten in, I believe, earlier than Huey. Huey won in 28. He was 35 when he was elected, but Jindal almost beat him, and then he was elected when he was 36, but out at 44, and it's going to be hard for him to reinvent himself in Louisiana. Maybe he can come like Sam Houston and get elected governor somewhere else, and one governor of two states.
So what is, I mean, kind of bringing this to Louisiana a little bit, what do you think of the election of Jeff Landry? You know, it was kind of uneventful. It looked like he won that thing right out. I mean, what is that saying about us? And is the Democratic Party in Louisiana pretty much dead? Is it, I mean, are they just kind of wandering in the wilderness right now? What's going on there?
I think it's on life support. And Landry is probably going to be a governor for two terms, but you never know. Louisiana, since I talked about 79, when in 79, Dave Treen won. He was a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 83, Edwin Edwards won, and he was a Democrat. And then in 87, it was Buddy Romer. He was elected as a Democrat but became a Republican. Then he leaves. It's back to the Democrat Edwards, then to Mike Foster, a Republican, to Kathleen Blanco, a Democrat, to Bobby Jindal, a Republican, to John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, to Jeff Landry, a Republican. So we've gone back and forth, but it is now a case in which the Democratic Party is not in good shape in Louisiana, and it's become, unfortunately, racially polarized. We're only six white Democrats left in the Louisiana legislature, 144 members and six white Democrats. And when I first started covering the Capitol, most of them, well over 120 members, were white Democrats. But that's not the case any longer. But what we're going to see, I think, in Louisiana, we're going to have factions within the Republican Party. Like we used to have in the Democratic Party. In 1987, when Edwin Edwards lost, he was challenged not only by Republican Bob Livingston, but by fellow Democrats, Buddy Romer, Billy Tozan, Jim Brown, former Congressman Speedy Long. They all ran against Edwards as Democrats. And I think we may see that in the Republican Party soon. We're not there yet, but we're either going to have a resurgence of the Democratic Party, or we're going to have Republican light. And the Democratic Party, even though it doesn't hold statewide office, it controls most of the big cities because there is a Democratic majority. East Baton Rouge Parish, for example, which used to be a Republican stronghold, is now a Democratic stronghold. This parish that where I live, it went for Obama, it went for Hillary Clinton, it went for Biden. It went for Foster Campbell over John Kennedy. It went for Mary Landrieu over Bill Cassidy. So it is a Democratic parish. We've had mayor after mayor elected since 2004, one Democrat after another. But the state as a whole is a Republican state, and Jeff Landry, if he doesn't really mess up, I think he'll win another term, but he's doing some things. He's not resting on his laurels, shall we say. And for people who say they're shocked at how bold he's been, and I think this is exactly 100 days since he was inaugurated, he's been extremely forceful in what he wants for our state, and why not? He was elected without a runoff, and even though most of the people in the state didn't vote, people also make a choice not to vote. And in this case, 65% of those made a choice not to vote, but of those who did, a majority of them voted over for Jeff Landry over 15 candidates, and some of them spent a lot of money, and they didn't do well. So I think he deserves, as a new governor, every good wish, and I think it'd be good for our state if he succeeds, and I don't think he's a bad man. He's just, he's a conservative with a capital C, and he believes that's where the state is right now, and maybe he's right.
What do you think of this change in the Constitution? I know that's the big talk right now.
Yeah, and that one, it's going to be tough to pull that one off, because this is where we're getting the first evidence of a split in the Republican ranks. Cameron Henry, who heads the Senate, is not in accord with Landry on the timeline for this. He doesn't want lawmakers to go past June 3rd. They've already been there for two special sessions, now a regular session. Landry would like to keep them there, I think, until August. and Henry says they're just worn out.
Right.
And another thing, making lawmakers delegates to a constitutional convention is not necessarily a good thing, because lawmakers often do things because they have their eye on the next election. They want to keep winning, and sometimes they might even say things and be in favor of things that they're personally not, because they're representing a constituency. Where I think delegates to a constitutional convention should do what they believe is the right thing for the state, independent of any political interference. And the plan on the table right now is to have every lawmaker a delegate to the convention. I personally think there's a better way of doing that. But Jeff Landry is striking while the iron is hot. And if Donald Trump wins the presidency, I think if he wants to go, there would be a spot in Washington for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was a congressman, and he liked it a lot in Washington. He liked it a whole lot. He could run for the Senate in 3 years, 2 years now, 2 years and 2.5 years against Bill Cassidy.
Yep.
And it looks like we'll have closed primaries, and I think Landry would be the favorite if he ran against Cassidy. So he has lots of options, but that would also partially explain why he is doing things so readily right now.
Aggressively
is the right word. He's not holding back at all.
No, he's not sitting there looking at the office. He is very aggressive.
No, he's not a caretaker. Mm-hmm. Now, John Bel Edwards, I think he would have been the same kind of governor, but he didn't have a supermajority in both houses, mm-hmm. Both the House and the Senate. So Landry does. But John Bel Edwards, I think, is quite possibly going to run again in 3 years now. I don't know that, but I think it's a possibility. But they could also change the Constitution where he couldn't run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They could say two terms and that's it.
You're done.
But all these things have to be approved by the electorate,
right,
too.
It's not
you can't do it unilaterally. And some of these things, you got to be careful if you go too far, because
a lot of sacred stuff in that Constitution.
I'm
going to tell you, I'm a little nervous. Mm-hmm. I ain't going to lie to you.
And it affects the budget, and it could be good, it could be bad. And also, if you like Jeff Landry and you say, look, let's just let him do what he wants and let's see what happens. Well, what happens if you get a governor you don't like?
You don't like.
Exactly.
Yep.
Then that governor has the same power that Landry has.
That's right.
Well, there was an article, I forgot where I read it. It was one of the local papers around here saying that he's going back for the emperor of Louisiana.
Well,
back to the Huey P. Long days,
well,
where the governor was the true emperor of Louisiana.
He is getting a new nickname, Huey P. Landry.
Huey P. Landry.
You said something about Edwin Edwards, and he ran for, what was it, Congress? Was it Congress or the Senate?
He ran for Congress 10 years ago.
Right.
And he ran in a gerrymandered district. If he had run in a the district that they've just drawn, he probably would have won.
He probably would have won, but I would have loved to have seen him, that little Cajun, doing his first filibuster and just talking and talking and talking. I would have loved to have seen that.
He could talk.
He could talk.
And I was fortunate to interview him many times, and actually many times in his last years. And I used to give speeches and still do, but when there was a hostile audience or one just not really responding, the line that was solid gold, I would say, Edwin Edwards was going to be here tonight, but he had to be rushed to the hospital. And they, ooh, and I'd say, he had to be present for the birth of his fourth wife.
That's funny.
Hey, he's the guy who said a man is only as old as the woman he feels.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had a lot of charisma and humor, kind of like Ronald Reagan. He could use humor to win over an audience.
Yeah. Well, Reagan was an actor and an amiable guy, and didn't appear to have malice in his heart. And I don't think he did. Now, Edwin Edwards could have been a stand up comic.
He was funny.
He was that good, and he was so quick. When he was acquitted in his federal trial in New Orleans in 1986. They had a lot of national media there, and he was governor at that time. And first reporter said, Governor, what do you say to the feds who say, what do you say to those who say the feds were, you're guilty as hell, the feds just weren't smart enough to catch you? He said, they're half right.
I believe what was the federal prosecutor, was that Stan Bardwell?
Well, that was Stan Bardwell in Baton Rouge, but the guy who indicted him in New Orleans was John Voltz. And Voltz, he got a hung jury the first time, and then they came back, and Edwards got an acquittal the second time. And he went to jail at 75 for 10 years. That was the sentence. He got out 8.5 years. He got a little bit off of his sentence, but he went to jail at 75, and Frank Palazzolo sentenced him, and it amounted to a life sentence, and he ended up outliving Palazzolo. And he said, they sent me away for life, and I came out with a wife, and she was 51 years his junior.
Yeah.
Wow. 51 years. And when he was in jail, I interviewed him shortly after he got out, and I asked him, he acknowledged that he was an atheist, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And I said, you didn't pray when you were in prison? He said, would you? I said, yeah, I'd pray a lot to get me out of this for godforsaken place. He goes, no, I didn't pray. So I said, well, when's the last time you prayed? He said, I prayed this morning that this would be a good interview, and obviously my prayers were not answered.
Oh, wow. Man. He was something.
There will never be another like Edwin Washington Edwards, who lived a full life.
A lot of times they'll say Edwards was and kind of the heir of Huey Long. I think somebody that gets forgotten is Earl Long. I find it more. I mean, what do you think Earl Long's legacy? Well,
he was governor three times, and he died right after he'd won a congressional race. He never served, but he won in 1960. And of the last 12 governors, he's the only one I haven't interviewed.
I don't
think I'm going to be interviewing Earl, but if he hadn't been Huey's brother, he was a character, and I think there's no doubt that he kind of lost his mind at the end, and he had an affair with Blaze Starr.
That's right, yep.
And he was from Winfield, Louisiana, as was O.K. Allen, and Huey Long, that small town in North Louisiana, which I think has produced more governors than New Orleans. That's where the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame is, appropriately. But Earl was every bit the character that Huey was, and they weren't that far apart in age. It is interesting. Huey was born in 1893, and I think Earl was born in 1895, and they were like the seventh and eighth kids.
Oh, wow.
Aren't most leaders like firstborn?
Yeah, firstborn. Exactly.
But it makes you wonder what was before them to cause them to be the way they were. Both were brilliant guys too. There's no question about that. But they do have the legacy we were talking about. It's probably as much of a residual effect of Earl Long is Huey Long, because Earl was around a lot longer, pardon the pun. And but we're talking about two brothers who dominated the Louisiana political landscape from 1928 to 1960.
I know.
So mm-hmm. that's 32 years, and that's a long, long time. And I do go by Huey's grave, and I talk with him. I'm trying to get him to be the 12th governor I've interviewed, but so far he hasn't answered me back. But I regret that I never got to meet the kingfish. But that state capital, that's Huey Long. He affected our state largely, I think, in a positive way, but his methods were not positive. And when people compare Jeff Landry to Huey Long, he's got more power than Huey Long had. Huey Long got impeached. Mm-hmm. Jeff Landry's not going to be impeached.
Right.
He's got a supermajority. Even if he did something really bad, he wouldn't be impeached. But Huey, he barely lasted. He barely survived. And he had to use force to stay in office. But those who live by the sword
often die by the sword.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. What about, remember Kip Holden? What did you think about Kip? He was the mayor, and he was also a Louisiana representative for a while. He had a lot to do in the state.
Kip had a vision, and he was, I think, a mayor who made things happen. And he was elected three times, and he was part of that transformation of Baton Rouge from a red city to a blue city. And the second time he was elected, and talk about the success he had in his first term, the second time he carried every precinct, So he was one of those black politicians who transcended race. And I remember the Bayou Country Superfest that he started. He invited me to go with him once, and I did, and I sat in his suite and next to Sean Connery's son, by the way,
okay.
Jason Connery. Kip hobnobbed with a lot of famous people, but I was amazed because we went outside, and here's this black liberal Democrat, and he's being embraced by all these guys in cowboy hats who aren't black, and it's like they all want to have their photo taken with Melvin Kip Holden, and unfortunately, he's fighting dementia.
Yes, he is.
Right. And
the last time I went and saw him, he didn't recognize me. I was actually on his campaign staff for a while.
You knew him and liked him, I'm sure.
Oh, I loved him.
But he's not an old man. He's born in 1952.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's 71 years old.
He's fighting
which
hard.
Means he is more than a decade. Well, he's a decade younger than Biden. Mm-hmm. And he's 7 years younger than Trump. and the poor man, that shows
right.
you.
Yeah. Right.
It's scary because it happened fast. Mm-hmm. I really didn't see any real signs of that when he was mayor. And he wasn't mayor that long ago. He was mayor into 2016.
Yep.
But he came from nothing, too. I mean, nothing. He did shows with me and talked about how his mother at time dated the most notorious drug dealer in the state. Mm-hmm. And there were shootouts at his house. And it was a case in which it was a miraculous thing that he survived and lived. But he's fighting hard to stay alive. And he was a study in resilience. Started as a journalist, by the way.
Yep.
As did Sharon Weston Broome.
Why do you think when he ran for governor, why do you think there was such opposition? He was so popular.
For a lieutenant governor?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, lieutenant.
Well, you know, he does hold the record for a minority candidate as far as statewide votes. Mm-hmm. He got right at 46% of the votes against Billy Nungesser. So he ran a very good race, and he would have been elected in 2015 if he had won. And you can imagine this battle he's fighting probably would have been while he was lieutenant governor.
Yeah. All
right. But he, right now, I think in order for a black person to win in Louisiana statewide, they'd have to be a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they can win as a Democrat right now, but things change, and cycles come and go, and I've told people who are Democrats who are fearful of a Trump comeback that if Trump wins, it's just the nature of American politics, if Trump wins this year, That means in 2026, the Democrats will get a huge wave in the midterm elections and then likely will win the presidency in 2028. Where if Biden wins, Republicans will probably get the wave in 2026, yep. and the next president will be a Republican. Mm-hmm. But Trump is one of those people that those who dislike him so intensely that we just can't take that chance, Jim. We just can't take that mm-hmm. chance. Well, the country has survived worse. We did survive a civil war, but now the weaponry is such that we could be vaporized, all of us on the planet, in a day. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some concern by many that Trump is not stable. And I don't know that that's the case, but and I do think that if any president, whether it's Trump, Biden, or somebody else, tried to do something really crazy, we have safeguards in yes. place where they couldn't pull it off. But I'm not sure that's true in other places. And now some of these countries do have nuclear capacity, which could be mm-hmm. devastating.
Yes.
Imagine what the Dow Jones Industrial Average would do if a nuclear weapon were used anywhere in the world.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And for those who think stuff,
just one.
And it's like, wait and see what happens. And mm-hmm. then if there's a response,
it's over.
Look out.
It's all over.
You know, that's so funny that you talk about nuclear war and Trump, because I recall when Reagan was running, the talk at the time, Reagan was going to start World War III.
Well,
and I'm hearing kind of the same kind of.
But with Trump, different. Trump was the only president in the
that I just
in
find
the near past that didn't get us into a war.
Right. I find you it know. Funny that the same kind of talk is about, I remember yeah. during Reagan at you know the SDI and Star Wars and all that mm-hmm. stuff was going on. He was going to get us in World War III, and I'm you hear the same thing mm-hmm. with Trump. And well, it's just funny.
Well, everybody was scared of Reagan because they didn't know what he was going to do because he was a Democrat turned Republican. Donald Trump is a Democrat returned Republican, and they're scared of what he's going to do mm-hmm. and because you really don't know.
Well, yeah.
Well, that was 1980 when Reagan was elected, mm-hmm. and he talked tough, but sometimes talking tough helps.
Well, the day he took office, what happened?
Well, the hostages were
they released every hostage and said, please, here you guys, know, don't kill us all, you know.
But the thing about it, in 1980, we were 35 years removed from the U.S. using nuclear weapons in Japan. And now we're 44 years removed from 1980. So I think then there was a real concern that it wasn't a question of if but when nuclear weapons would be used. There have been some close calls, and Reagan was one of those people who he had an exotic background, as did Jimmy Carter, for that mm-hmm. matter. You know, Carter was a peanut farmer, and he one-term governor of Georgia, became president, and his lack of experience showed, and Reagan was an actor, two-term governor of California, and he is remembered as a better-than-average president, as is Bill Clinton, by the way, who was hated by the Republicans. But now, in retrospect, Clinton seems like a moderate. Imagine today if a president were to propose what Clinton did, and it probably cost the Democrats the 94 midterms, when the don't ask, don't tell, mm-hmm. which was considered to be heresy to have gays in the military. And Clinton proposed it. But today, if a president were to propose exactly the same thing, they would be considered a homophobe. Mm-hmm. And that shows you how times change.
It's interesting, times too, change. That you brought up the fact that, like, you know, we're so far removed from that first nuclear attack on Japan that, like, I'm starting to think about it. I was like, am I mistaken that, like, I know there's been some pretty big things that have happened over the past handful of years, but I remember the last thing that I was like scared of as far as war was the Twin Towers in 01, and that was over 20 years ago. And like, and now there's people that are, you know, again, like I said, voting age, old enough now that weren't around
you
during
were
that time.
7 years old, then, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I couldn't comprehend what was happening, but it was a big deal to my parents. It was a big deal to the community I was a part of. It was like. It impacted, again, even though my child brain couldn't understand what was going on, it was like the world around me was changing in such a way where everyone was scared about it. And well, I don't remember anything in recent years that has been quite as
that was
pivotal.
Unusual in that the United States was attacked that day, but it was done presumably by some rogue elements not affiliated with an official government. But all of those guys were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And yet we didn't go to war with, the United States didn't go to war with Saudi Arabia. We went to war with Iraq and Saddam Hussein, who was no saint. He had nothing to do with 9/11, but right. We went to war as a country against him. And we, at the same time, the Saudi prince was visiting George Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. And they were the ones. Those hijackers were from Saudi Arabia.
Some of them were trained here in Louisiana.
They may have been.
On the planes. Yep. They got their pilot training in Louisiana.
And that was a crazy, crazy thing to do. Who would do something like that because they're giving their life? But I do remember they were called cowards, and no, they're crazy, but when somebody flies a plane into a building, I don't think they're a coward. They're crazy. And, and
they're very committed to their cause.
Well, we're laughing, but we're laughing to keep from crying because, my God, that was a horrible day. And but our country united on that one. But that one, that's talk about TV. Mm-hmm. That was a visual, searing memory that I can still see.
I was in 23 Panama City, and I was putting on a scuba suit. I was getting ready to go scuba diving, and I turned the TV on, and the first tower was burning. And I had about 8 friends with me, and I said, "Wow, they just redid the fire suppression system on these towers. How can it be burning?" And I literally watched the second plane hit. And I scream out to everybody, get up, the world just changed.
Yeah.
That was just, I can remember it like it was yesterday.
Well, and then they hit the Pentagon.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that one that crashed in Pennsylvania was headed for the Capitol.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, if that would have happened.
Well, and think of those guys on that plane that went down in Pennsylvania who
stopped that.
They gave their lives to try to stop it. But if they hadn't, it would have just gone right into the.
Was it the Capitol or the White House? I'm trying to remember.
Well, I think it was the Capitol.
Yeah,
it was the Capitol. But
either one.
Yeah, but it was a horrible day, and if that's what it takes to unite the country, that's a terrible way to do it. But it happened then. But now I'm not even sure it would do it. I think people would be blaming one side or the other, saying that they were responsible for it. And
it would be a fear attack, considering the timing, if it happened in the next month or so. Well, it would just be another fear tactic for the election. Like you said, blaming somebody else.
And neither party has a monopoly on virtue.
No.
People are people. And
I 100% agree with that statement.
And now we know that misinformation wins elections, and sometimes we're willing to basically sell our souls to try to get power because we presume if we have power, we can do good things. But ultimately, if you do bad things to try to do good things, that there's a disconnect there, and karma always catches us at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Wow. Is there anything else you guys wanted to touch on, or was that that's a
good closing point, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Man, we really appreciate you coming out.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for coming.
And if you ever want to come back, please let us know. This has been interesting. And
Ian and Jason, thank you.
Having somebody that's so well-versed in this political scene, especially in Louisiana and the country, this has been fascinating.
Well,
and I have 30 more questions. I just didn't have time to get to them. So if you ever want to come back, please come on back. You're part of the Retrospect family now, and if there's something you want to say, you're welcome to use our platform to do it, and As long as it's not ugly. We don't do ugly well, here. We do serious and we do lighthearted, but we don't. We just don't do ugly.
And this is like a super secret hideaway. I feel like you're Bruce Wayne.
Or Batcave.
Yeah. The Batcave. Huh? That's right. Well, you know, with the Stony for President hashtag, I'm getting ready to start my campaign now. So
Bruce Wayne in his stately manner.
That's right.
All right. Well, I know this is probably going to be, this is a big episode that I feel like people are going to want to ask questions about or talk about probably. So if you have some more short form responses you want to give to us, we have a Facebook page / Retrospect Pod where you can go ahead and give us those. We also have an email address, getoffendedtogether@gmail.com, where you can give us those long form responses, because I know you guys probably will have some.
And y'all do. We've gotten a couple of four pagers. So we have a very intellectual following.
Please keep me posted. Yeah, yes. Well, I can tell you. You go places others won't and others don't. So congrats on your success, and
thank you.
Glad to be part of your show.
Awesome. But, well, with all that being said, thank you so much for listening, and until next week, bye-bye.
Goodbye, everyone. God bless.
God bless you. Good night.
Hey, thank you for hanging out with us for this very interesting conversation today. You are the best. Peace.